Welcome, everyone, to Jewish History Soundbites. This is Yehuda Geber with another episode of Jewish History Soundbites. And this episode has been generously sponsored. This episode about Washington Heights has been generously sponsored in memory of Chaim ben David v'Reyasoy, Moshe Mordechai ben Tzvi v'Reyasoy. And it should be for their memory. And I want to remind you at this point that sponsorships are available for additional cities, which in our ongoing series of great American Jewish cities, there are some cities that are still available for sponsorships, and regular episodes are also available for sponsorships, so you can be in touch with me about that. I also want to, you know, this episode is about Washington Heights, so I want to apologize for the late posting. It was all ready to go yesterday, and I had already all my notes and everything, and I decided I'm going to call Rabbi and Rebbetzin Schachter as like an afterthought to ask them for their favorite stories about the Heights. I know they're, besides for being very, very prominent Gedolei Yisrael, but they're also a long-time residents of the neighborhood, and on that angle, I wanted to hear if they have any good stories. So I called them up, and instead of a couple of minutes, it ended up being a couple of hours. And some fantastic stories and memories that they very graciously shared, Rabbi Herschel and Rebbetzin Shoshana Schachter. And I was privileged to be able to speak to them. So I reorganized all the notes, and now it's going to be two parts. We have to divide. It's too long to be in one part. And some great stories, some in general, and many are from them, and I hope I remember to credit them for every single one that they gave, but just in case I neglect to, so you should know from the start that much of what is going to be said comes from the stories that I just heard from them last night. In fact, I play for both sides of the team in Washington Heights. Washington Heights is famous as both the home of Yeshiva University, as well as being the center of the Kehillah of Kahal Hadas Yeshurun, of Rabbi Breuer's Kehillah, later Shimon Schwab, the Yekis, the German Jews who set up their community there, which is also, you know, both sides of the story. So my personal connection is on both sides. I have the privilege to be married into the Katzenstein family, which is a Yekki aristocracy, very much part of the rich Yekki history in Washington Heights, the Katzenstein family. They played a big role there, and they're related to all kinds of people there. So that's on one side. And on the other side, the only time I ever spent a Shabbos in Manhattan anywhere was when I was by the Schachter family many years ago. Rabbi and Rebbetzin Schachter's son, Shai, who's now, the up and coming rabbis, one of the biggest community rabbis, shul rabbis in America. Now, so I knew him when he was still we together in the Mir Yeshiva, and I guess Rabbi Shai now. We were both by Rabbi Asher Arieli together. We were roommates in the dormitory together. So I was able to spend the Shabbos by him and his parents when I was still single many years ago. And that Shabbos kind of I got the whole neighborhood. I got the whole story of the neighborhood in that Shabbos. It kind of encapsulates it, because when I arrived on Friday afternoon, I couldn't find any parking. And that was definitely the introduction to the neighborhood. Spent an hour in the pouring rain looking for parking, had a lot of people honking at me. And then Friday night, I davened in Breuer's in the main shul. And then the next day, we walked through the neighborhood and got to see, you know, all the other residents of the neighborhood, and then we davened and learned in the yeshiva in YU, got a tour of the campus. So I kind of got everything in there. So I play for both sides of the team. In fact, my wife's grandfather, the Katzenstein. So he, despite being part of the Breuer's community, and there's always a bit of a tension between the two sides of the neighborhood, OIU and the Kahal Hadas KAJ, there's different different ideals and different ideas, and Tayru Umada and Tayrim Derech Eretz, and there's different nuances and close proximity in a city neighborhood. But despite the fact that he was a member of KAJ, so he went to YU. And he was a chemist, he was a big Talmud Chacham, he was actually, later on when he lived in Baltimore, he was one of the only Balabatim to have ever received smicha from Rav Ruderman. And either way, many years later, so he told me this story. He said many years later, he was at some sort of social gathering, a simcha of some sorts, and he was speaking with the distinguished-looking Talmud Chacham, and over the course of their conversation, it came across, he asked, my wife's grandfather asked him, Kassenstein asked him, where he had learned when he was in his youth. And he said, oh, I learned here, I learned there, I also learned at some place in Manhattan, in New York City. So he leans over to him, my grandfather leans over to him, and he says, it's okay, you can say the truth, you don't have to hide it from me, I also learned in YU. So that brings out a little bit of the excitement of the neighborhood. Now, just a little bit of background of the neighborhood before we get into the real stuff. It's, you know, the northernmost tip of Manhattan, and although the Jewish population was very dominant for many years, but also a lot of immigrants from the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico, you know, the famous baseball player Manny Ramirez, who grew up in the Dominican Republic, moved to Washington Heights when his family moved here, and speaking of baseball, Lou Gehrig was born in Washington Heights and lived almost his entire rather short life in Washington Heights, with Yankee Stadium, the Bronx, being right across, right there. In fact, Vin Scully, he was born in the Bronx, but he grew up in Washington Heights. There's a lot of baseball stuff. In fact, the Polo Grounds, the old Giants stadium, was basically, you know, the edge of the neighborhood, in the neighborhood. Coogan's Bluff is right in Washington Heights. And so there's, you know, a historic place that the Polo Grounds full of history, you know, Willie Mays' famous catch and the shot heard around the world by Bobby Thompson and Ray Chapman being killed by a pitch and Christy Mathewson, of course, is a pitcher there. There's so much to go on just about the Polo Grounds, but that's enough of baseball for now. In the context of what's going on today in the United States, so Malcolm X was assassinated in Washington Heights in 1965. That's another part of the neighborhood. Alan Greenspan, the head of the Federal Reserve, who was also born in the Heights. Jacob Javits, the senator from New York, lived for a time in Washington Heights. And of course, as part of what we're going to speak about, the German-Jewish refugees running away from the Nazis, fleeing the Nazis in the 1930s. So Henry Kissinger was also the one who lived in the Heights for many years, so which we'll get back to. And it's in that during that time when there's this massive Jewish immigration to Washington Heights during the 1930s that it receives its name, that it's known by as Frankfurt on the Hudson, even though there's a lot of German Jews, Austrian Jews, a lot of people fleeing from the Nazis in the 1930s. But Frankfurt became the dominant kehila, Rav Breuer, Rav Schwab, the KJ kehila, so it became to be nicknamed Frankfurt on the Hudson. In fact, the YU campus actually was there first. There was it moved from the east side in January 1929, and Rav Revel, who was in charge of YU at the time, wasn't YU, it was Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan and Yeshiva College. It wasn't the Yeshiva University yet. And he projected building a big campus, and he built the main building in what many shuls in Europe in the same style, a Moorish revival style that a lot of the prominent shuls, especially in Central Europe and Hungary and Czechoslovakia and Germany, Austria and other places, were built. He was modeling the first university building to ever built like that, because he was showing that it's not just a university, it should remind you of a shul, not a regular university. And he has all these grandiose plans, and he had to put the plans on hold because January 1929 they move in, and a few months later, October 1929, the Great Depression breaks out, and the ensuing high unemployment and bad economy, And so they remain small and they only build up over time. Now I'm not going to focus on the YU part of the neighborhood. I'll bring in a little bit here and there and a few good stories here and there, just in the context of the neighborhood, because YU deserves its own episode, and hopefully we'll get to that. We have been doing a few on personalities from YU. Maybe we'll get to YU itself one day. So we'll just mention it in passing in the context of the neighborhood. In fact, in the late 1930s, Rev Revel makes an effort to bring over rabbis, providing visas for and affidavits for different rabbis to be able to make it out of Europe in time. And one of those rabbis was Rev Breuer. Mr. Jacob Samuel was the one who encouraged Rev Breuer, and he hosted him, and he pushed for it, and he made the sh and he spoke to Rev Revel. So Mr. Samuel was the catalyst, and then Rev Revel was the one who provided the visa at the beginning of the war. And Rev Breuer was able to come over, even spoke to Rev Revel about the possibility of becoming a rabbi in YU, but it was never under serious consideration, and that idea was dropped very quickly. So we have during the 1930s a lot of German and Austrian Jews arriving from Germany, fleeing from the Nazis. They don't go to the Lower East Side. They don't go to for the most part, they don't go to Brooklyn. They end up in Washington Heights. Why Washington Heights? There's a lot of reasons. It already was a Jewish neighborhood, already at the turn of the century. There are already quite a few shuls there. The Upper West Side was the established German neighborhood, and these penniless refugees, for the most part, couldn't afford the Upper West Side, and this was kind of nearby and it was cheaper. The Lower East Side and most neighborhoods in Brooklyn had the reputation of being for Eastern European Jews, and back in Germany, the German Jews called them Ostjuden, Eastern Jews, and also, they preferred to stay in their own neighborhoods. And there are other factors involved also, and it's also a domino effect. Once a few families settle there, they encourage their friends and families to settle there also. And soon enough, Washington Heights becomes a destination for all the German Jews. There's you're talking about tens of thousands, over 20,000 German Jewish refugees, mostly secular. There are some Orthodox, but mostly secular. And like I said, it already was a Jewish neighborhood with quite a few shuls. In fact, Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, the Slabodka Rosh Yeshiva, one of his trips to the United States, he spent the Shabbos in Washington Heights, and the whole Shabbos afternoon he was AWOL. They couldn't find him; he was missing. And Rav Baruch Kaplan said, related this story. You have to work out the years; a little tricky because when this story happened, but possibly it did happen, and they found him sitting on a bench in the neighborhood, admiring the construction of the George Washington Bridge, which was under construction at the time. And of course, that's a major feature of the neighborhood and changed both Manhattan and New Jersey and Washington Heights once that was built. Now, what Rav Breuer's vision was when he made it over, he made it over in 1939. He left after Kristallnacht. He stayed in Frankfurt almost to the end. And he decided, and when he came here, he was invited by a group of Jews, recently arrived Orthodox Jews from Frankfurt, to come to their little minyan. They had a Shabbos minyan. So he comes to their Shabbos minyan. And after Shabbos davening, he says to them, "Well, what time is Shachris tomorrow morning?" And they said, "Well, we don't have a weekday minyan. We only have a Shabbos minyan." So he says, "Okay, so let's start a weekday minyan." And when he moved into the neighborhood, he hosted the weekday minyan in his private home. Three times a day, a weekday minyan in his home, where he had little kids still, not so little actually. He was right in his 50s. Rav Breuer pretty much lived forever. He was like 98 when he passed away. So he decided that he's not just going to have a shul, he's going to build a community, a kehillah. And that was his vision. He's not going to limit it to becoming a Rav Shul. He was, when back in Frankfurt, he was a Rosh Yeshiva. He was the reshiva of the Reb Shabbos Shneur Hirsch Yeshiva in Frankfurt, and he was also the rav of one of the shuls there. But he was not the rav of the kehillah, of the community. His father was, or Shlomo Breuer, Rabbi Dr. Solomon Breuer. His grandfather, of course, Rabbeinu Hirsch, Rabbi Shamshon Raphael Hirsch was, but he wasn't. There was other Rabbanim who were the Rav. And he decides he's going to model the Kehila that he's going to build and call it the same name, Kaldas Ashurin, after the Frankfurt Kehila. And the first thing he does is build a mikvah. He said, there's no such thing as a community without a mikvah. And before we build a shul, before we build a school, we're building a mikvah. And even though we're talking about cash-strapped refugees during wartime, in a pretty desperate situation, he forges ahead and he builds the mikvah in 1943. And he says this is going to be a whole community. It's not going to be a shul. It's not going to be just a school. It's going to be everything. That's the idea of the Frankfurt Kehila. That's the idea of the Reb Shapshner Fol Hirsch Kehila, that the Kehila provides all the spiritual needs of its people, or even all the social needs. There's a hall, and he forms a Chever Kaddish, and they buy a plot of land in New Jersey for a cemetery. He starts his own Hashgacha. First his own Shechita, and ironically, nearby in Yonkers, the Rav in Yonkers, Rav Alexander Rosenberg, who was the Kashrus expert, and this is before he founds OU Kashrus. Rav Rosenberg helps out Rav Breuer start his own Hashgacha. Rav Breuer has this Hashgacha become a pioneer in Chalav Yisrael, because there's no compromising in Chalav Yisrael when the rest of America was, had the Tzelem HaRav a little bit, started the first Chalav Yisrael, but Rav Breuer took it to a new level, and before it was readily available in the city, and most people were relying on the eating Chalav Stam and regular milk, Rav Breuer, no compromising, we're having Chalav Yisrael. He starts a publishing house to translate Rav Hirsch's Sfarim into English. He starts a community newsletter, the Mitteilungen, and I probably heard the name 40 times, and I still don't know how to pronounce it. And when does that start? In September 1939, right after his arrival. And it starts off mainly articles in German. Most of the articles he writes, eventually it switches over to English. They still had some. It was mixed German and English for most of its years. And he writes literally hundreds of articles for it. He starts his own Besden. He brings in Dayanim. Starts a shul. Starts schools. Boys, girls, high schools. He starts a butcher. He says a community has to have a kosher butcher, a kosher bakery, a kosher matzah bakery. In 1940, his wife, Rebbetzin Rika Breuer, start the sisterhood of the community. And he used to speak to them and explain the importance of the role that the sisterhood has to play in the Kehila. Now, the Kehila model is something that it's important to understand. It's almost non-existent in the post-war. We almost don't know what it is. And that's the real story here. And that's the reason that the story of this neighborhood, more than any other city in this great American Jewish history series, it's the story of a specific Kehila, along with everything else that went on in the neighborhood, of course. But the KJ Kehila is really a story of how to rebuild a community in its entirety and its completion. Before Breuer, he in addition, he wanted it to keep all the customs from Frankfurt. But like I said, there was many German Jews in the neighborhood who were not from Frankfurt, from all over Germany. So he wanted to accommodate all the German Jews. So he even modified some of the customs in the shul and in the community that there wouldn't be specifically Frankfurt, but all Ashkenaz, all of Germany, which, for the Yekis was a big thing to modify the customs. He took a lot of pride in the choir that the shul had. A lot of pride. My wife's grandmother, Katzenstein, said one of the last things one of his dying wishes was to keep the choir strong. And in fact, in his tzava, in his will, he mentions the choir three times. That's how important it was. Now, interestingly enough, a lot of the songs that are sung by the choir was composed by a fellow by the name of Lewandowski. And Lewandowski composed most of his songs for Reform temples back in Germany. And these songs are used in KJ. And KJ was the big one fighting the Reform. Reb Shamshon Raphael Hirsch was fighting the Reform back in Germany. So Reb Shimon Schwab was very much bothered by that. And Rav Shechter told me that he was bothered by it, and he had someone ask Rav Shimon Shua, what's the reason that Lewandowski's songs are used in KHA if he composed them for the Reform temples? And Rav Schwab says, I was bothered by this for years. And the answer that I came up with is that he didn't actually compose the song. These are ancient nigunim, old songs that Lewandowski touched up. He changed, he modified, he made it more for choir singing, and he played around with it, and that's why it's attributed to him. But really, the original compositions was older songs. Now, since Lewandowski was composing it for Reform temples, and Reform temples there was mixed men and women singing, and of course in KAJ there would be nothing of the kind. So how do they do so? The tunes were made for choir singing, and women have different types of voices than men. So the KAJ solution was to have little boys. They would sing the parts that were originally meant for women. Now the choir, both the boys and the adults, had to come to choir. Have to come to choir practice every week. If you miss it, you're not allowed to sing in the choir. They're very insistent on minhagim, on their customs. Very keep every custom strong. You daven there Friday night and you hear the choir and the chazan and the way the get-up, the costume of the chazan, it's something to see, and it's a great experience. The decorum that the shul has, very orderly, the way that you walk up the steps to the Aron Kodesh, and when you open the curtain to the Aron Kodesh is in sync with what they're up to in the song. Everything is exactly, perfectly, the number step you're up to has to correspond to if they're up to Mi Yale Bahar Hashem, in the singing in the choir. And if you take out the Sifrei Torah from the Aron Kodesh, and the guy stands on top of the bima holding the Sifrei Torah and these beautiful silver crowns, and it really is a magnificent scene, a regality of the experience. And in 1952, when the shul was built, the kehillah had more than 800 families. So it was a booming kehillah, and if you want to compare it to other communities in 1952, a lot of the big Hasidic rabbis were still barely scratching a minyan in other parts of New York City at the time. And here the kehillah had more than 800 families. It was booming. It was financially stable. Today we don't even know what a kehillah is, what a community is. But that used to be, that's really a topic for itself, to explain what a community, what a kehillah structure was and how it developed. But that used to be everything. And it's disappeared in the modern era. A lot of factors involved. First, the Hasidic movement changed the kehillah structure. Then the yeshiva world came and changed the kehillah structure. And then you're talking about still in the 1800s and the 19th century, the 19th and 20th century, excuse me. And eventually the governments of Europe stopped recognizing the independent or the autonomous kehillah structure. Of course, the migration to the big cities, the urbanization, in which there were huge Jewish populations in big, busy, bustling cities, also damaged or changed. I don't want to say damaged, that's judgmental. Fundamentally changed the kehillah structure. So to be able to take a group of refugees in a world where the kehillah no longer exists, to envision it and to recognize its importance and to bring it to fruition is absolutely not a small feat. And definitely a topic that should be fleshed out in general. Now, besides for YU, and which I'm going to get back to, and Rav Breuer's kehillah, which I'm also going to get back to, it's important to note that, like I said, there are other Jews who live there, like German Jewish refugees from other parts of Germany. In fact, I gave a great example. There was a fellow by the name of Rabbi Dr. Leo Yehuda Breslauer. And he's a great example of a Yeki Rav and the community in Washington Heights that was not affiliated with the Breuer's community. He was a Rav in Fiert, and he only arrives in America in 1941 in the middle of the war. He stayed with his community till basically the very end. He comes to the United States, and he takes over a refugee community from those areas of Germany that he had come from Fiert, from Nuremberg. In fact, Henry Kissinger's family was part of his shul. And he was Henry Kissinger's rabbi. He officiated at Henry Kissinger's bar mitzvah. He was the Masader Kedushin at his wedding. He had, on the one hand, he had a doctorate, Rabbi Breslauer, but he's also a big kanoi, a very big anti-Zionist. He was very active in the Agudas Yisrael, but on his Jewish calendar at home, he would cross out Yom HaTzmaut on the calendar. He wrote quite extensively in Hebrew and English and German, left over an archive. His son, Reb Shlomo Breslauer, was my fourth grade Rebbe in Yeshiva Spring Valley in Muncie. He was a big Rav and a Paisik in Muncie and based Fila. And he was a long time Rebbe in Yeshiva Spring Valley and a long time Mael. So that was Rabbi Breslauer's son. In fact, there was also a Hasidic Shtiebel in Washington Heights. The Dumbrava Rebbe, Ramatcha David Unger, who was the was not in Washington Heights. He was the founder of the Dumbrav Hasidic dynasty. He was a Talmud of the Chayze of Lublin, also knew the Noam Elimelech himself, and it was a Galitzianer dynasty. And eventually they married into Tzanz, also one of their Tzanz Dumbrav descendants, moved to the United States and was a Rav, I think, in Crown Heights, the other Heights. And his son is the current Bubov 45 Rebbe, and his name is Ramatcha David Unger, and he's named obviously for the dynasty's founder. But either way, getting back to Washington Heights, at one point there was another descendant of the Dumbrava Rebbe, who was a Reuben. This Dumbrav branch of the Hasidus, Dumbrav is simply a town in Galicia, was Rabbi Sacher Baruch Reuben, and he moved to Germany from Galicia. And he becomes a Hasidic Rebbe in Berlin, which perhaps was the first in Hasidus also. And there were, like I mentioned about the Ostjuden, the Eastern European Jews, there was migration west. Migration west mainly went to America, but some settled down in Western European countries, Germany and Belgium and France and England. And there was many Eastern European Jews, Polish Jews, Litvish Jews living in Berlin. And so there was the Chassidus Shtiebel, the Dumbrava Rebbe lived in Berlin. In Frankfurt, there was less because that's all the way in the west side of Germany, southwest Germany. Berlin is much closer to the Polish border, and there was much more Ostjuden in Berlin. Now he then, when the Nazis come to power, moves to America. And I guess because he came from Germany, so he settles in Washington Heights and he opens a Shtiebel. When he passes away in 1952, his son, Rabbi Yisrael, becomes the next Dumbrava Rebbe. And he's also in Washington Heights. So there were other shuls as well. But if we get back to the Yekkes, so you have Rav Breuer, you have Rav Shimon Schwab, you have the president of the Kehila, Dr. Rafal Muller, who was Muller, German names are hard to pronounce, and whose daughter I know very well. She's my great aunt. And he was, he literally built the community, Dr. Muller. You have Rabbi Posen, who was brought in as a dayan by Rav Breuer. You have one of my wife's relatives, Manfred Katzenstein, who is one of the leaders of the community, one of the Katzenstein brothers, and Harry Levy, and later on Rabbi Zachariah Gelli is brought in as one of the Rabbanim. You have the Chazanim, who bring the traditions from Frankfurt, like Robert Frankel and David Kenner, and each one was a personality, and each one added to the building of this kehila. Now, the singing customs themselves were interesting. I mentioned the choir earlier, but they had actually a different kaddish for every different tune that they sang kaddish for every occasion of the year, every holiday, and the same tune would be by Shir Hamalos or Shir Hamalos by benching. It was a different tune for every yomtiv. Every occasion, a bris, a Purim, Pesach, a wedding, they all had, and I'm not talking about the famous Yeki Shir Hamalos that they sing at all kinds of occasions, I'm talking about the tunes that they sing for Shir Hamalos before benching. Now, this is a wild party in KJ. On Simchas Torah, this is out of control Yekis. They sing the year Kaddish, the year's Kaddish, or the Simchas Torah Kaddish. They sing all the year's tunes in one Kaddish. And that's a big party. Now, L'chadaydi, even though originally in Frankfurt they didn't sing L'chadaydi because it was a new custom, it only came 500 years ago, but eventually it crept in. They sing L'chadaydi, but they sing L'chadaydi also, specific L'chadaydis for every time of the year, every period of the year. I remember I was in Beit Vegan for Shabbos by my wife's grandparents, and they davened at a Yaki Shul in Beit Vegan, the Groshul, ironic name for a Yaki Shul, and the guy had the audacity to sing the wrong L'chadaydi. It was during the year, and he sang the L'chadaydi from the 3 weeks niggun. I guess it was a sadder song. It's hard to tell what's sadder and what's less sad in Yeki's songs, but it was he sang the wrong song. And immediately, well, his grandfather's mood went sour. And the whole way out of shul, he's talking to all his friends. And he says, the guy sang the Lechadaudi from the drei Wochen, from the 3 weeks, and it's not the 3 weeks now. And when he came home, my grandmother asked him, how was shul? He said, shul was lousy. The chazan sang the Lechadaudi from the drei Wochen, and it's not the 3 weeks now. And these things are very important to keep the customs of old, and that's definitely one of the features of the Kehillah. Of course, the Tayrim Derech Eretz and the separatists, the Austrit of separating, which is, I guess, what would add to the tension with other communities in the neighborhood, like YU. The idea that when Frankfurt, the KAJ Kehillah, the Kaddash Shurim Kehillah, was not associated with the other Orthodox Kehillah in the neighborhood. Rav Shamshon Afol Hirsch's vision and what he fought for of Austrit, of separating the Orthodox Kehillah, that it shouldn't recognize any other stream of Judaism. And if an Orthodox community is not as extreme about their positions in Orthodoxy, so they didn't recognize that back in Frankfurt, and therefore it might have added to the tension, because Austrit was a very strong component in Rav Breuer's philosophy as well. Now, the Rav Breuer himself was a true leader of the community. He, like I said, the way he started, about what time is Shachris tomorrow morning, he wrote endlessly for the Kehillah newsletter on a range of basically every conceivable issue. It's hard to find another Gadol B'Yisrael of his age, of his generation, who had what to say with clarity on every issue imaginable of his day, on education, on Torah, on business, on current events, on the Kehillah, on Eretz Yisrael, on everything. Today they compiled a bunch of it into a book. It's called A Unique Perspective, fantastic book. He tried to emphasize how Torah Derech Eretz is relevant today, and we're going to implement it, but it's very different than Torah Umada, and therefore there was that tension between the two communities. Though, like I said, Dr. Revel was the one who brought him in together with Mr. Jacob Samuel, and they did have a cordial relationship, but he definitely never taught there. Rav Breuer was very patriotic towards the United States of America, and he goes on to build the institutions that the community would need to be able to build itself up. And one of the first things he builds is the yeshiva. Yeshiva's Rabbeinu Shamshon Rafal Hirsch. He brings in very impressive Rashi yeshiva, first from Naftali Friedler, later on the Novominska Rebbe, Rabbi Yaakov Perlow. They add on, and they had an elementary school, they have a high school, there's a post-high school, they even had a koil, which is not exactly the Frankfurt tradition, but in the 20th century, that's what became accepted, and they had a koil there as well. The original high school that Rav Breuer started, the first Rebbe there was Rav Simcha Wasserman, the son of Rav Elchanan, and Rav Shraga Feivel Mendelovich helped Rav Breuer start it. Rav Shraga Feivel had a big affinity to Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch and his whole philosophy of Torah Derech Eretz. He was very close to Rav Breuer, and the idea that they were going to start a high school that had secular studies, not just that they had secular studies, but they saw secular studies as being an ideal because of Torah Derech Eretz. So it met opposition. And one of the opposition was ironically from Reb Mendel Zaks, and of course Reb Aaron Cutler, and therefore it shut down after a few years and only opened much later in the 1950s. The elementary school, though, flourished, both the boys' school and the girls' school, and the girls' high school. And Rav Breuer wrote the curriculum, and he included that they should study the entire Tanakh. Rav Breuer loved Tanakh, so did Rav Schwab. They gave shiurim in Tanakh. In fact, Rav Breuer's shiurim in Tanakh were in German, but Hauch German, Hauchdeutsch, High German. And Rav Schechter told me that even though he studied German in college and spoke a fluent Yiddish, he went to Rav Breuer's Navi shiurim and he did not understand his German. Rav Shimon Schwab, one of the innovations that he brought in when he became the Rav together with Rav Breuer in 1958 when he was shipped in from Baltimore, so was to give shiurim in English, which would would bring in the younger generation who didn't grow up on the on the on German. So the Tayrim Derech Eretz permeated the school. The ones who ran the school in an administrative sense were Harry Levy and Manfred Katzenstein, who were business partners, but everyone saw them running the yeshiva all the time. And they were very active in the kehila. And they said, these people, these two balabatim, are running the kehila and running the yeshiva, and their whole business partnership is just a front for their real job, which is to run the yeshiva. That's the way they spoke about these dedicated individuals. So the high school reopens in the 1950s. One of the reasons it opened only then was the Rav Breuer's philosophy was to only initiate building more institutions when they had the internal finances within the community to sustain it and to build it. That's a very, very rare position to take in the Jewish world. And once we mentioned the Breuer's yeshiva, so one of the most prominent alumni that it produced is the current Biyana Rebbe, who went to the yeshiva before he went to Terva Das and before he went into training to become the Biyana Rebbe. Eventually, after Breuer's wife passed away, it's Rika Breuer, so they didn't just have a high school for girls, but they opened a teacher's seminary for girls. And today, these institutions all are still there. Today, because of what we'll speak about later, because a lot of the Yekis and members of the Rav Breuer's community moved out to Muncie and other places, so now there's more of the YU community populating these yeshivas than the Yekis, which is another irony. Now, Rebbe, wow. Okay, so we'll stop it here, and part two will come very soon, and I'll continue with the story in part two. So this has been Yehuda Geber with Jewish History Soundbites, part one of Washington Heights, and you can reach me at Yehuda@YehudaGeberer.com. Geber is G-E-B-E-R-E-R for questions, comments, sources, tours and trips to places of interest to Jewish history. And you can subscribe to Jewish History Soundbites on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter @JSoundbites. Check out our website, YehudaGeberer.com. And I hope you enjoyed.